This in rural Alaska is great. Of those who have, there are also studies that have shown that among Alaska Native rural resident parents of preschool children, they smoke marijuana, have recently used marijuana at 3 times the national average. 1 in 5 Alaskan rural resident parents have used marijuana recently, as opposed to about 1 out of 16 nationwide. It really, in some senses, it should be no surprise then that that so many children are using marijuana. Of those high school students who have used marijuana, 1/4 started using it before the age of 13. In a study involving the Northwest Arctic School District, in middle school students, of middle school students who had who were surveyed, 10% had started using marijuana before the age of 11. I think it's alarming that that so many students are using it, and so many are in treatment. In 1976, there were under 60 people in Alaska who were referred for drug treatment with marijuana as the primary drug of abuse. Now that number is several hundred, and half of those are children aged 12 to 17. Is there any hope in sight? I think it's fair to say, and studies certainly show, that to the extent your parents disapprove of marijuana, you are much less likely to use it. If your parents do not approve of marijuana, or if they use it themselves, you're about 3.5 times more likely to use it in your teens. There is an inverse relationship between the perceived risk of marijuana and the penalties and its use. In other words, the higher you perceive that it is risky behavior, the less you are likely to use it. So what does the legislature do when the courts have said it's okay to use it? How do we stop parents from using it so that their kids won't use it? That's what this hearing is about. That's what this bill is about. By adopting the findings that are set out in the bill, by considering the documentary evidence and the testimony that we will provide to you, we believe that that will establish a legislative record that the courts will defer to when the question of marijuana and its use in Alaska is before the courts again. In other words, the courts in the Raven decision had no legislative record to turn to. They had no evidence that was presented in any legislative hearings. And the courts have indicated, the Alaska court has indicated, that it doesn't sit like a legislature. It doesn't weigh the evidence like a legislature does. But when the legislature hasn't acted, when the legislature has held no hearings, the court has no choice but to do it itself. Right now the court has refused to do it, has refused the state's request to do it. This is the only forum left for this subject to be aired, and that's why we're here today. With that as a preamble, I'd be happy to answer any questions. If the bridge is open and any of the out-of-state witnesses are available, and otherwise, then Captain Al Story is available from the troopers. And
thank you. Any questions for Mr. Guarnelli? We have two, Senator Olson and Senator Owen.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. As we look at the tab B in one of the bullet points, the third bullet point down says marijuana was the most commonly used drug of Alaskan prisoners. Are you saying that 93% of the inmates that are there now are currently using marijuana while they're incarcerated?
Through the chair, Senator Wilson, I think that refers to have used marijuana in the past. My belief is that all of these bullets in this study talk about just shortly to when they were incarcerated.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. Just a couple of questions. I was reading your kind of cliff notes on the front of this, and I appreciate it because I haven't yet cracked the book, Mr. Guarnelli. But one of the things that struck me is you talk about Nationally, more teens are in treatment each year for marijuana dependence and for alcohol and all other illegal drugs combined. And when I read that, I thought, oh my God, that can't be true, given, you know, the anecdotal stuff that I see in my community and other communities that I've traveled to. I mean, that may be true nationally, but I mean, is it true in our state that teens abusing alcohol are outnumbered by teens abusing marijuana in treatment programs?
Through the chair, Senator Elton, I know that figure is true nationally, and I would defer to Christy Wheeler from the Division of Behavioral Health to answer any further questions about Alaska-specific numbers.
Thanks, Dean. And the other question?
Can we wait until she testifies to answer your question?
Well, sure. Yeah, that's fine. Okay. I had one other question of Mr. Guarnelli, and please, if there's somebody better to answer this one, too, just say so. You say that marijuana affects driving for up to 3 hours after use. Residual effects have been reported 24 hours after use. I mean, I'm struggling kind of with the notion, and you and I had a conversation a couple of days ago. I mean, I read an awful lot in stories about traffic injuries, traffic fatalities, that more likely than not, alcohol was involved. And alcohol was a contributing factor to the injury or the fatality. I mean, I don't recall reading any news reports that, and maybe I've just missed them, but there haven't been many, I don't think, about marijuana causing the traffic accident. So I'm having a difficult time, I guess, trying to judge the magnitude of the issue of marijuana use and traffic injuries or fatalities, and alcohol and the issue of traffic injuries and fatalities. I mean, is marijuana a close second or a distant second? I mean, try to put this in some kind of perspective that will bump me out of what I've been reading in the newspapers.
Through the chair, Senator Elton, Captain Story will talk about some more specifics about marijuana and driving and the efforts that the state troopers are making to try to get training that will allow them to identify drivers using marijuana. I think that the studies show that marijuana seems to be the second leading substance of abuse of drivers. And that is not involving alcohol as well, but just involving marijuana. And why those studies don't get as much attention as one might expect, I think may be attributed to the fact that there are a lot of other substance of abuse in this country that get more media attention than marijuana, and that includes cocaine and methamphetamine these days. As two of the primary ones that get a lot more attention, but frankly, I think the statistics about use by children, the number of the age of first use, some of the statistics that have been developed, you know, in Alaska itself, that really have not been greatly publicized, I think is an indication that society has sort of stuck its head in the sand when it comes to marijuana, and I think it's time to change that.
Just to follow up, again, there may be somebody better able to answer this. I mean, the cliff notes here say epidemiology data from traffic arrests and fatal accidents show that marijuana is second only to alcohol as the most frequent substance of abuse among the drivers. I guess it would be more helpful to me to try and put this in perspective. It suggests that it's second only to alcohol, but I'd like to know how often it's a contributing factor to a traffic accident or a traffic that leads to injury or fatality. Just so I can get some, I mean, one of the concerns that I have is that we have the big elephant over here that we know is a huge problem, drunken driving. And I shouldn't say this, but I mean, I almost favor cutting off the throttle foot of somebody who drives drunk And I'm worried that what we're going to be doing is shifting some focus to something that isn't as big a problem and doesn't contribute to as many traffic accidents, injuries, or fatality.
Through the chair, I think that the question of whether there ought to be focus shifted on shifted away from alcohol and onto marijuana is perhaps a separate policy debate as to how the troopers ought to allocate the resources. And again, troopers, Captain Story will be able to tell you what they're doing in that regard. I think the situation now is that the state really can't do much about adults using marijuana. I mean, when an adult can possess up to a quarter pound, every adult in your house can have up to a quarter pound of marijuana, and when using the marijuana in your home affects your driving for 3 hours and in some cases much longer than that, I think that is that's a public health concern, it's a public welfare concern that I don't think ought to be overlooked. And to the extent that by the legislature adopting certain findings and having the court overturn the line that the court has drawn at 4 ounces of marijuana, I think that alone goes a long way towards expressing the state's disapproval of marijuana, discouraging parents from using marijuana, discouraging drivers from using marijuana, whether they use marijuana in their own home or not. There is an effect outside of them, effect on their kids, effect on the driving public. Whether or not that means that a lot of law enforcement resources should be shifted away from other things toward marijuana, I think that's a separate debate. What we're trying to do here is establish a legislative record that will allow us to get back, put the marijuana laws back on the footing that I think the voters wanted to establish in 1990 when they recriminalized marijuana. The last vote by the voters was that they want marijuana to be a crime, and the courts have simply prohibited that from occurring. We want to fulfill the will of the voters, and if that means that the troopers don't do anything different, I think that's a separate question.
Further questions? All right, Senator Olson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. You might not be the person to be asking this question, but under tab D and A, I apologize because I just looked at this in a cursory manner. Bullet 4. It talks about smoking marijuana may increase the risk of head and neck cancers. And as I look at some of the issues that are there, marijuana use and increased use increase the risk of squamous cell carcinoma in the head and neck, article apparently by Zong et al. As I look back at the information that's backing this up, I guess I'm seeing a wide distribution of malignancies that are there, and I certainly don't see any alarming difference between squamous cell, I'm assuming carcinoma, as well as other cancers that are there. Do you feel familiar enough with the data and the information from these journal articles to go ahead and comment on that?
Through the chair, Senator Olson, frankly, I did not. We had planned to have a doctor, an expert on the physical effects of marijuana, be able to testify, and that's not possible at this point. I'm not a physician, I'm not a statistician, and I simply, when the University of California at Los Angeles, Health Center and Medical School, comes to those conclusions, I tend to accept it, but I certainly am not qualified.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Maybe you or one of your folks you got here could quickly run down through me what are the differences in the schedules? 1, 2, 3, we've got through 6A, I think it's here. Or maybe Senator Olson can do it for us.
I'm not buying it.
The controlled substance schedule.
I can do it in general terms, and okay. in terms of the Schedule 1A, A standing for Alaska. Schedule 1A is generally opiates, heroin, morphine, drugs of that sort. Schedule 2 are a large number of drugs of abuse, and Captain Story can correct me if I'm wrong, cocaine, LSD, methamphetamine, drugs of that sort.
Come on up. You're going to be up next anyways. Please, sir. And identify yourself for the record.
Captain Al Story, the Alaska State Trooper.
How am I doing so far, Al?
You're doing good.
Okay. Schedule 3...
2 was...
2 is a lot of the drugs of abuse, the cocaine, methamphetamine, LSD, those types of drugs. And if I had the statutes, I could quickly look them up. Schedule 3A involves... you start talking about more prescription-type drugs involving... some of the Valium related drugs, I think.
Oxycontin.
Quaaludes, drugs of that sort.
Right. If I might, the schedules are based on the strength of the drugs and based on the probability of addiction of the drugs. That's why the opium, heroin, and the dilaudids, oxycontins are Schedule 1 under Alaska statute, are Schedule 1A. Methamphetamine and cocaine is a Schedule 2A because they're viewed to be slightly less addictive, but certainly are a substance that, it's, when abused, is very bad. And then, as Mr. Goodell is alluding to, then you get into the prescriptions going into the Schedule 3s, 4s, and 5s. Under Alaska statutes, marijuana is a Schedule 6A controlled substance, indicating that it's considered to be not very addictive, but I might point out that under the federal statute, it's still on Schedule 1 controlled substance, the equivalent of heroin.
And marijuana is the only Schedule 6A substance.
Right. And does this bill, if it passes, will it move marijuana from Schedule 6 to Schedule 1?
Mr. Chairman, no, it does not. It leaves it as a Schedule 6 drug. And it also makes no change to the medical marijuana law that's on the books. What this bill does is three essential things. One, it asks the legislature to adopt a number of findings about marijuana and about what's currently known about marijuana. Two, it makes certain adjustments to the current laws involving marijuana. The lines that are specifically drawn in the statute as to, for example, what amount of marijuana it forms the dividing line between a misdemeanor and a felony.
Yep.
And it also adopts some laws regarding having marijuana in cars. And then finally it makes some changes to the way that marijuana is measured, the way that live growing marijuana plants are measured, which is a separate subject that I can get into in more detail at the proper time.
Thank you. That helped that for me. And at some point, I would enjoy some idea what are the difference between Schedule 3, 4, and 5, and what are the, I think, psychoactive prescription drugs that are there. We don't need to know that right now. All right, this concludes your...
It does.
You can stay there if you like. All right, Captain Story, thank you for coming.
It's my pleasure. This is a topic that I'm certainly involved with. Let me give a little bit of my background. I've been with the Alaska State Troopers 25 years as of last week, and I'm a bit of an oddity in our department in that out of the 25 years, I spent 18 of it in drug enforcement.
Oh.
A long time doing a lot of interdiction work at the Anchorage Airport, doing a lot of undercover work. I was a scent detection canine handler for 8.5 years. I've supervised several of our units, the airport detail, the Western Alaska Alcohol and Narcotics Team, the Mat-Su Drug Enforcement Unit, and I was the commander of the statewide drug enforcement unit for about 3 years, from July 2000 till July of 2003, when I moved to a staff position at headquarters. So drug enforcement is something that I've quite frankly lived for a long time, and I have an interest in all aspects of drug enforcement. But I have to admit that we spend a lot of effort doing marijuana eradication, especially in the Mat-Su Valley and certain areas surrounding Fairbanks and on the Kenai Peninsula. And at times you can get tired of doing marijuana eradication, especially with the court decisions that we've been getting. It can kind of take the energy out of our efforts. And the standard that is required to do marijuana-type investigations is substantially higher than any other criminal offense that I'm aware of. And get tired, but last year I hired a young clerk that works at our headquarters building in Anchorage, and she's from one of the Western Villages. Very pretty, very bright young lady. And one of the first things she said to me when I explained to her I'd been in the drug unit for years is that she said, "Cab stories, there's something you can do about marijuana in the villages." I said, "Well, you know, our perception is that alcohol is the issue." And she says it is. But in her village, and I don't want to, out of fairness to the village, name it, but in her village, all the teens or all the youngsters are smoking dope. They're not doing anything except smoking dope. They're dropping out of school. They're not continuing their education. They're not doing anything productive. They're just smoking dope. So that's what feeds my passion to come down here and talk to the legislator about it, because the problem is growing in the villages. Our marijuana eradication efforts have tapered off in the last couple of years substantially. We had about 14,000 plants, I think, in Alaska eradicated in 99, as I recall. And those numbers are down to about 4,000 in 2004. Several reasons for that. One of them is that meth labs are on the rise, and we spend a lot of resources addressing meth lab eradication. But the other reason is because of the case law that is coming out of the Court of Appeals against our efforts to eradicate marijuana. The result of that, of course, is I think there's a large amount of marijuana being produced. It's a historically large amounts being produced. Now is even larger amounts, and now marijuana's got to go into the marketplace, and it's going to the villages. Where our seizures of marijuana going to the villages are up substantially.
So, Captain Story, is the stuff that's being distributed to our remote communities, villages, is that largely homegrown? Is that imported?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. If it's not widely known, let me address that. That's an excellent issue, Senator. Alaska is self-sufficient in marijuana. We grow all the marijuana that we can use, and we grow enough to ship to other states. When I started in drug enforcement back in 1982, we interdicted at the Anchorage Airport large amounts of marijuana coming in from other states, from Hawaii, California, Mexico on occasion. I mean, multi-pound shipments.
About BC
Bud. BC is new on the scene the last 3 or 4 years.
And I understood that there's some coming in here in Southeastern.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. And I can certainly speak to that. But the trend is reversed, and when it comes to marijuana in Alaska, it is now the number one cash crop of Alaska. There's no question about that. And we export marijuana in substantial amounts to Hawaii, and occasionally we get shipments going to California and Washington and Oregon, even though BC Bud's kind of cut into that market a bit. But shipments going to Hawaii are very, very common. I have to admit that we're not very successful in interdicting them, but we have informants and other organizations that tell us that there's large amounts of marijuana going to Hawaii. And if you've ever walked the beach there, you'll have people approaching you trying to sell you some Matsu marijuana because it is a very desirable commodity.
We had a major bust here in Southeast stuff coming in.
A couple of years ago, we'd had 40 pounds that was picked up on a float plane coming out of British Columbia, ahead of the Ketchikan. It's our belief, based on our investigation, that the pilot landed at one of the nearby islands, offloaded the dope, was probably going to fly into Ketchikan to clear customs and go back and pick up the dope. Unfortunately, hit a rock with a pontoon and sank the airplane. Then was foolish enough to try and get somebody to take him back to the scene, who got suspicious, who reported it to police. One of our troopers ran down there and found the 40 pounds hidden in the brush near where the plane had gone down. And he was convicted. I don't know what his sentence was. I do have the press article here somewhere, but we do have other sources of information to tell us that there are frequent shipments of BC Bud coming in to Alaska and certainly into the lower 48. That's become a billion-dollar business for Western Alaska.
Is our stuff going out? Does that go out commercially or private aviation or boats?
Well, it's our belief that there's a sophisticated distribution organizations in Alaska. And let me qualify that a little bit by saying that, again, we haven't been very successful in breaking into those organizations. An analogy I can use, I grew up on a farm in Wisconsin, and every other day the milk truck came around, collected up your milk products and took it and introduced it into the distribution system at the milk factory or is pasteurized and bottled. We do marijuana eradication. Frequently, the people tell us, well, there's a guy that comes around who gets my product. You know, I grow it, I harvest it, I groom it. After I dry it, he comes around, he brings his own scale, sets it up, weighs my product, gives me cash, he takes the dope and goes. And that dope's going somewhere. And then follow on, we also have other informants that tell us that frequently it is shipped through the U.S. mail, shipped through air cargo carriers, shipped through luggage, in suitcases as these people travel to and from Hawaii, being one of the most common places. Of course, now it's being frequently shipped to the villages. Again, through the U.S. mail, through luggage, through packaging services, you know, we're making fairly substantial interdictions of packages going out. We have an excellent relationship with the U.S. Postal Inspector's Office to do package interdictions, and not only of alcohol, which we do a lot of, but also controlled substances. But let me talk a little bit about what marijuana is in Alaska. We have this vision that we have a lot of people maybe growing 6 or 8 plants in the backyard, and they started growing those from seed. Our marijuana grows here in Alaska, I mean, in some ways you have to take your hats off to them because they're very good. They grow some excellent products, and they do it through an organized process. Marijuana here, the vast majority of these plants are not from seed, they're from clones. Somebody develops an excellent strain of marijuana plants, and they take clippings off of that, and they root those clippings, and then they grow that into a mature plant. And if you get the good, you get the good stuff, you get a good clone, or you get a family of good plants, you can grow some excellent drugs or excellent dope. That's why the THC content has gone from roughly 2% in 1975 to, on the average, about 14% here in Alaska. But that's a bit of an anomaly because most of the dope that we harvest in places like the Matsu Valley or the Kenai Peninsula commonly runs 16-17%. For many years, Alaska held the national high for THC at roughly 29%. It's since been overshadowed by some seizures down in Oregon that hit 30%, and BC buds even hitting a little bit better than that. But for years, out of a grow we did in Coppa Center, we had almost 29% dope. And we frequently still, and Dr. Alsui can testify to that, get a marijuana that ranges in the 16-17% THC content, substantially different than 1975. But as they're growing this dope, there's a lot of effort, a lot of money, and a lot of work that goes into this because it is a very profitable enterprise. You have to have a good facility. You have to have good ventilation. You have to have good lighting. You have to get good plant nutrients to them. You have to have good knowledge of how to do this. And there's certain lightings that cause these plants to grow very quickly if you're properly feeding them. As they come into the budding stages, there are certain things that good growers know what to do. They start out, again, with the clippings. They root those, go into seedlings, bring them into what I typically call a teenage plant, mid-growth plant, and then they move them into the mature rooms. They actually move them from room to room because it's such a sophisticated process and it's so dependent upon proper light control and temperature control and humidity control that when they bring them into the budding stages in the budding rooms, they end up with these magnificent buds. And there's some photos, I think, in your binders that show some of those. And my hat's kind of off of these guys for the quality of the product that they can grow. It's unfortunate they're not growing orchids yet. In one picture that that's some Boone and Crockett dope. That is not an uncommon bud. We get bud like that on a frequent basis. And that bud will have very high THC content. As I recall from this grow, this dope was running better than 20% THC. They then harvest these buds. They cut them off. They dry them. They groom those plants down. And frequently they'll take the very best parts of those buds to make it available on the market as their saleable product. That's not to say that the leaves don't have THC in them, because they do, but it's such a low quality THC that they want, you know, better business through better products. They want that best bud, so that's what is most commonly available, That's what our people are telling us that they're seizing that's going to the villages. That's what our people are telling us that the teenagers are buying. Not the leaves that we kind of picture from Cheech and Chong Airs, but they're buying that best bud with the high THC content.
Mr. Chairman, would you just review for me what THC is?
It's the active ingredient in marijuana, tetrahydrocannabinol is the...
Tetrahydro.
Yeah, that's why they abbreviated the THC.
What's the third word?
Tetrahydrocannabinol. And that's the active ingredient. That's what gives people that desired effect of marijuana, is the THC content. Now, as Mr. Guanelli alluded to, a teen going out to want to buy a little bit of dope on a Friday night for recreational purposes, if he's going to buy an ounce, it's going to run about $325 to $350 in the Mat-Su Anchorage area. The farther you get from the growing source, the more that goes up. And it's not uncommon for him in some of the other areas, Bethel, Nome, those kind of areas, to pay $500 an ounce. But a pound of good dope in the Anchorage area is going for about $4,000, typically $3,800 to $4,000. Again, farther it gets from the source, the more that price goes up. And we eradicated a grow in the Mat-Su Valley here a couple of years ago that I was involved with. Lady didn't sell in the Anchorage area, Mat-Su. Everything she produced went to the Nome and Unalakleet area, and she was getting $9,000 a pound out there for marijuana. Huge profit margins. I mean, huge. And this lady was living in a very nice house, fully equipped, far better than my house. New boat, new car, new motorhome, not paying any taxes, and all she was doing is sending dope to the villages where the hardship is created so that she could live in a lifestyle that she chose to live in. Typically.
So what's a kid out in Western Alaska going to pay for a joint?
I was just going to get to that, Senator. Okay. Typically, we make interdictions at the Anchorage Airport of marijuana shipments that are already made into joints. Some of these are very small joints, having a quarter to a half pound of marijuana in them will sell for $20. So it's not uncommon, as we hear from the villages, that after a Friday night basketball game in the village, they may be out back smoking dope that they paid $20 for a joint. It's not an uncommon law. Typically, if they're buying a gram, and just for perception purposes, a gram weight-wise is about how much a little pack of equal weighs. So buying a gram of marijuana in the village commonly goes for about $50. We had an investigation out in Quinnahawk not too long ago, seized a fair amount of marijuana, and that's what they were paying out there. It was $50 a gram for it. Enormous profits to be made for this once they introduce it into the distribution system.
At least in the Anchorage area where I've lived the last 35 years or so, at least for the girls, they don't have to buy dope. You know, it's generally trade for services. Is that true in rural Alaska?
It is, unfortunate. I think Mr. Benelli alluded to it a little bit in that the amount of sexual assaults and things that go on in rural Alaska. It's unfortunate. Alaska leads the nation, as you all well know from some of the hearings that have been occurring and some of the material you've been exposed to. It leads the nation in sexual assault. Is marijuana contributing that? I can't say that marijuana makes people sexually aggressive. I can't say that it makes them violent. But it seems that a large number of the people that are the suspects of sexual assaults, and then a large number of the victims that are involved in sexual assaults, have marijuana on board. Did it affect their judgment? Did it affect their thinking? I think it's fair to draw that nexus, yes.
Reduces inhibitions.
I think that's a fair statement, and certainly clouds their thinking and certainly affects their judgment, which leads to the next thing I wanted to talk about. We talked a little bit earlier, I think, with Mr. Guanelli about marijuana and driving, and I think it's fair to say that the psychological effects from driving after having consumed marijuana do dissipate fairly rapidly, within 2 to 3 hours. But there's still that residual effect of having your mind clouded by a controlled substance that'll linger for several hours, 12 to 24 hours in some of my readings, based on some university studies that show that people are still unable to do cognitive projects, thinking projects, 12 to 24 hours later, their mind still is not totally clear. But let me add that, you know, having been in the drug unit that many years, I've spent hundreds if not thousands of hours on surveillance, where you just sit and watch for a particular activity. And during that, you see many other activities that are going on. And I gotta say, it is not uncommon to see people driving while they're smoking dope. I mean, they're hitting the pipe as they're going down the road. They're hitting the pipe while they're stopped at the intersection. And just last Friday night in downtown Eagle River, I pull up to a red light, look over, the passenger lights up the pipe, hands it to the driver, the light changes, and they drive away. Well, I'm scrambling for my cell phone. I'm in my POV with my wife. I'm scrambling for my cell phone, but they got out on the highway and got away before APD was able to respond. So, I mean, we have to give consideration to that also, not only that a guy was at home smoking dope and then got in his car and drove, and maybe he's sobered up, maybe not, but they're doing it while they're driving. They're doing it while they're doing other activities.
Excuse me. This room is scheduled for another committee at 1:30. How much more time do you think your testimony will take, sir?
I could talk for hours, Senator, but let me wrap up real quickly, if I could, in the next few minutes. So I think the implications of driving under the influence are strong. We believe that there is a large number of people who are driving under the influence. The question was asked earlier, why don't we have greater statistics in that? The answer to that is because it's very difficult to detect people that are under the influence of marijuana while they're driving. We frequently stop vehicles that it's obvious that their driving is impaired. We run through our field sobriety tests that we use to detect alcohol, but we're not seeing the alcohol behavior. We may even get a preliminary breath test with a breath sampler, and we get no alcohol, but we still know that there's something wrong, but we don't have the skills or the ability to develop the probable cause to get blood or urine samples. We're now working on correcting that. We've had one trooper who finished what we call DRE training, drug recognition expert training, that is coming to Alaska, being facilitated by our crime lab. We got four other troopers that are about to complete drug recognition training. And if we have a driver who we feel is impaired, but it's not alcohol, we'll call one of these expert troopers to the scene and have them continue their examination of the suspect to determine whether there is enough probable cause to get blood or urine to make that determination. We do have a fair number of single vehicle accidents where the person leaves the roadway for no explainable reason. And I've read some research that shows that 60% of the vehicles that leave the road for an unexplained reason, and this is an explained reason would be a DUI, an unexplained would be maybe fell asleep, maybe some other reason. 60% of those people are because they did fall asleep, and you gotta think that marijuana maybe made them drowsy, made them more relaxed, caused them to fall asleep when they left the roadway. The other thing I wanted to speak to briefly. Is the crimes that Mr. Ganelli essentially recapped as well as I can recap them, if not better. But there are a large number of people that come into custody that have marijuana on board when they're taken into custody. The Adam report, I have a copy of it here. It's the annualized, I'm sorry, the adult male, let me back up one more time, Arrestee Drug Abuse Monitoring Program that was run by the University of Anchorage, or University of Alaska in Anchorage, of people that were taken into custody at the Anchorage jail facilities. And they interviewed people as they were coming through the door, asking them if they had taken any types of drugs, those kinds of questions. And then they followed that up with urine samples to confirm whether they actually had marijuana or other kinds of drugs on board. 52.5% of all the male arrestees in Anchorage in 2002 tested positive for marijuana. Again, 52.5% of the people being arrested in Anchorage during the course of this program had marijuana on board. Were they arrested because they were violent? Well, I can certainly supply a copy of this report. It may already be in your binder. I don't know. Did the marijuana again affect their decision to cause them to do something that then caused them to be arrested? Well, that's I think that conclusion can be made. Also, 69.2% of males arrested in Anchorage for domestic violence tested positive for marijuana. Again, 69% arrested for domestic violence tested positive for marijuana. Did marijuana make them violent? Well, I'm not prepared to make that statement. But again, did the marijuana affect their thinking processes? Did it affect their judgment? Well, based on my research and my experience over the years, I think that's a fair statement. The and of significance when it comes to the Bush, and a study in 1997, 62% of male arrestees at the YK Correctional Center in Columbia tested positive for marijuana. Again, in 1997, 62% of the males arrested at the YK Correctional Center tested positive for marijuana.
Senator Elton?
Thanks. Captain, thanks, and I appreciate the experience you're bringing to the table here. And so the question I have may sound naive to you. When you say tested positive, I mean, I don't know what that means. I mean, how long does the presence of marijuana in urine or blood linger? I mean, is that a month or is it a week or?
Well, it depends on the type of test. Through the chair, Senator Elton, there are some tests that are presumptive in nature that simply shows there's marijuana on board.
On board, you mean in their body, not on their person.
They got the marijuana. They have consumed marijuana. There's marijuana typically in a urine sample. I'm also a member of the Air Guard, have been for total military time, about 32 years, and the military has been using that kind of sampling for many years. Simply says that this person has marijuana in their system. Now, there are other types of tests, and I had a family member who through his union was required to do testing before he got dispatched to a work site, showed up with marijuana, much to the family's frustration. And I know through that process that when he went into rehabilitation, they were taking urine samples periodically, and it was nearly 30 days before he was completely clear of marijuana. And as they were taking those samples, they were able to tell how much residue he still had within him. So there are, again, different types of tests give you different abilities to quantify that.
We really need to wrap up here. Go ahead.
It wouldn't be unusual that when you say marijuana on board, it could have been marijuana use that happened a month ago.
It could have been. Correct.
Senator Olson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just so I'm aware of what's going on, you made several comments about your research into the subject, and that as we look at this, and you've talked about the changes in mental status, the changes that have gone on with somebody's clouded memory. Remind me what your credentials are, or as far as any specific studies that you've done to make it so that you've got scientific information that we can rely on and not just something anecdotal, as well as, or if you even studied the effects of marijuana in some type of a scientific guideline situation.
Sure, and that's a fair question, Senator. I have been in, like I said, started in drug enforcement in 1982. And one of the first things we learned, of course, are the types of drugs, the physiological and psychological effects that the drugs have on the human body. And we learn that normally is when we go through the DEA Basic Narcotic Investigator School. They spend a large amount of time teaching us what the physiological and psychological effects are of drugs. And of course, when you're in that business, you see it every day. You see people under the influences, you see what their behavior is, you see what their lifestyle is, you live it every day. But because I have a particular interest in the effects of drugs, I do pride myself in trying to do as much research and be as knowledgeable about the topic as I can. And back in 1991, prior to the vote to recriminalize marijuana, I spent a fair amount of time doing public presentations on why marijuana needed to be recriminalized, and I again tried to study the material as much as I could so that I understood the material. I remember one particular seminar, and I apologize, I don't remember her name, but a person who worked for the federal government did a presentation in Anchorage and talked in great detail about how the marijuana enters the body, what it does to the nerve cells, and how it interrupts the flow of the electronic energies within the nerve cell, how in adolescence it affects their sexual maturity, how it harms the body in those ways. But one thing she talked in great detail about was the fact that marijuana has over 400 different chemicals in it, many of them the same chemicals that are in cigarettes, the same tars, the same nicotines, the same carcinogens that are in cigarettes, and that we have to be aware that marijuana is as harmful as cigarettes, if not more harmful than cigarettes, because it burns at a higher temperature.
With all due respect, Mr. Chairman, that wasn't my question. My question, I'm assuming you're not a physician.
Oh, absolutely not.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Hey, we're going to stop our hearings today. We will reconvene, hopefully at 1:30 on Wednesday. Sorry for the delay. Appreciate your testimony. And I suspect your call, but Mr. Captain Story could, if you have more to contribute or questions, we can maybe be available by phone on Wednesday.
At least by phone, certainly.
Okay. Thank you. Thank you for your service. We're adjourned.